All right, we're in week four.
Week five.
Is it week five? Okay. I've lost track. That's good. Whatever week it is, it's a new week. I just want to begin with a small review of last week. So last week we spoke about two topics. One was bad moods and the other one was self-criticism. Bad moods, we talked about a Kabbalistic source of why actually our mood fluctuates. It comes from a good part, that we are flexible people. We integrate the different emotions, interact with each other. And that's why it's quite normal for moods to change and emotions to change. And we talked about the power of harnessing the different moods and using them for different achievements, emotional achievements or spiritual achievements or purpose achievements. Depending on what mood we're in, we can sort of engage in that type of reflection or that type of behavior, which would be in line with that emotion. Then we spend more time on the concept of self-criticism, and I just want to run through quickly the 5 points that we made. First one is that very often when we criticize and bash up ourselves, we're actually not accurate. Because of the Talmudic principle, which we explained at length last week, a person is related to themselves. And therefore, our subjectivity doesn't allow us always to be exactly accurate. At the same time, we talked about the importance of self-awareness, which is needed for growth. And we said that one of the ideas is that we read and we learned that when one makes a cheshbon, one makes an inventory, takes stock of their own growth, it needs the ability to know one's own strengths and weaknesses. And if you can do both, then you're probably closer to the truth than if you only focus on your strengths or you only focus on your weaknesses. Third point was that very often our self-criticism actually is a tactic of the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination to get us trapped in our failings and in our deficiencies and so on, which will then, the effect of that will be lack of growth and despondency and giving up hope and so on and so forth. Actually, I'll just pause here for a moment because actually it very much ties into an idea I saw this week, which is a beautiful idea in its own right. So this Shabbat is the Shabbat before Purim, and in Shul we read in addition to the weekly Torah portion, we read a special paragraph called Parashat Zachor, where the Torah commands us that we need to read this paragraph once a year in order to remember the atrocities of Amalek. Right? Amalek. Amalek was a nation that attacked the Jewish people when they came out of Egypt. They represent a physical evil, but also, as the commentaries explain, a spiritual evil. The evil of apathy, the evil of cynicism, the evil of losing enthusiasm and passion and so on. And therefore the Torah tells us we have to remember Amalek and be aware of it and timche et zecher Amalek, to actually erase and destroy the nation of Amalek. But when the Torah tells us about remembering Amalek, it says the following. It says, Zachor, you shall remember what Amalek did to you, baderech betzeitchem mimitzrayim, on the way when you left Egypt. Right? And the commentaries ask the question, the particular commentary I was reading this week, asked the question, why is it so important for the Torah, where every word is counted, to emphasize that you got to remember that whatever they did to you was on the way out of Egypt? What's the difference where it was? They were attacked as a nation. It doesn't matter where they were coming from, really. And also, what does it mean at the end when it says, Timche et Zecher Amalek? Erase the memory of Amalek. What does that mean? It should say erase Amalek, not erase the memory. What does that actually mean? So he says a very beautiful idea. He says that when someone does the wrong thing, when someone is engaged in evil, when someone has a failing, a mistake, a transgression, whatever it might be, what's worse than the mistake itself is the feeling of guilt and shame, negative guilt and negative shame that comes after the failing. In other words, when a person transgresses or a person fails, there's two pathways. One is to get stuck in the past, to get stuck in all the things that we did, and say I'm to self-criticize, to feel guilt, to feel shame, and then to feel that there's no way forward, that God doesn't want me anymore, God won't accept me anymore, I'm stuck in my mistakes, I'm stuck in my failings, therefore I don't really have a chance of growth and repair and rebuild and so on. Or no, we can remember that deep down we have a soul, the soul remains intact, the soul remains pure, God always loves us, notwithstanding that we might have messed up badly, and to move forward with hope, confidence, resilience, and the belief that God always accepts us, right? She says that's what Amalek is. Amalek, spiritually, is the idea that Amalek tells you to choose the path of being trapped in the past. And that's why it says, Zachor, remember what Amalek did to you on the way from Egypt. Egypt was a spiritual exile. It was a spiritual confinement. And the Jews left Egypt and they were on the way to become God's nation at Mount Sinai. So Amalek says to them, you're coming from Egypt. You're not going to make it to Mount Sinai. Look where you're coming from. You're coming from the depths. You're coming from the depths of impurity. Kabbalistically, we are, and the Talmud teaches us that the Jews in Egypt sunk and assimilated to the depths of evil, to the depths of impurity. They were on what Kabbalah calls the 49th level of impurity, which if they would descend one more level into the 50th, would be a point of no return. But they were the worst they could have been. And yet, there was a promise deep down that we're still connected to God. There was a promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that we would become God's nation and He would redeem us. So Amalek is that force that attacks after you come out of Mitzrayim, after you come out of a failing, a spiritual impurity. You come out of a dark place. Amalek says to you, where are you going? You think now you can grow? You think you can go to Mount Sinai? You think you become God's nation? You think you can reconnect? You think you can be alive again and spiritually aware? You come from Mitzrayim. So therefore the Torah says, remember what Amalek did to you when they told you to remember that you were coming from Egypt. Don't erase that. Destroy that. Because that's so untrue. You might be coming from the depths of Egypt, but you can still be making your way to Mount Sinai because you're always deeply, deep down, you're always intact, you're always connected, and there's always hope. And that's why the Torah says, at the end it says, Timche et Zecher Amalek. Erase the remembrance of Amalek. So he says a beautiful idea. He says, not to the remembrance of Amalek. You got to remember, you got to erase the memories that Amalek is trying to get you to remain in. Right? Timche, erase the zecher, the memories. Don't give room for those memories that Amalek wants you to remember. He wants you to get stuck in your past. He wants you to feel the guilt. He wants you to feel the shame. Erase those memories. Think about the future. Move on. Right?
Rabbi, wouldn't you, Hamas is like Amalek now,
can't you love it? Very similar, yes, absolutely. The depths of evil.
Yeah,
Trump just put out a thing warning them that they're going to be erased. So maybe he wants to fulfill the mitzvah. He's got.
How are we going to get out of it?
It's
not a Red Sea.
No, there is a Red Sea. It's got to split. Whatever's in the way will split. That's part of the belief, by the way. That's exactly the point, actually. Good point. The Jews also thought there was no path. They came to the Red Sea and they thought, maybe Amalek was right. Look, we're stuck. There's nowhere to go. God said, you just keep moving. You keep moving, the sea will split. Anyway, so that's just the third point we made last week, that the self-criticism is just a tactic to weigh us down and to prevent us moving forward. You know, I once just on this point, such an important point actually, because I once watched a video, you know, the famous Sunday dollars, the Lubavitcher Rebbe used to give dollars on a Sunday for people to give to charity, and there were very beautiful exchanges that would happen. And there was someone that came by the Rebbe, and he was introduced by a rabbi, and he said, this person was born Jewish and unfortunately converted and became a priest. And he regrets it now. He actually wants to return to Judaism, right? So this guy lived a whole life in like something completely the antithesis of Jewish belief, right? And you think he needs like a whole rehabilitation and, you know, maybe he needs to really visit his past and all that. And on the spot, the Rebbe just said to him, in Yiddish, he said, just forget about it all and just move on in Yiddish, guy. Just like move on in Judaism. Like, he's very, very into that. Not getting stuck in the what brought you here and what the problem was. Obviously, you need to be aware of that. We have Yom Kippur, that's Cheshbon. We talked about this, but that shouldn't be the focus. The focus is, okay, what am I doing now? What am I doing today? How am I moving forward? Right? That's why this obsession of self-criticism is often just a tactic of the evil energy which we have within us to hold us back.
The fifth thing we said to...
Yes, last week is the way to tell the difference between healthy discomfort in order to grow and negative guilt is what does it lead to? It's very simple. If it leads you to being more despondent, then you know it's wrong. If it leads you to create a sense of urgency to fix, repair, and rebuild, and reconnect, then it's good. And finally, the final point we made, and I told you the famous story of the Chafetz Chaim, that after all said and done, it's actually a transgression of the Torah. Torah says you can't talk Lashon Hara. You can't gossip. And the Chafetz Chaim told us through a story that he had on the train, I told you last week, that he learned that Lashon Hara is not only a prohibition to talk about others, it's a prohibition to talk badly about yourself as well. So that's why we shouldn't do that. Unless, of course, we need it for a purpose, to make us forward, to make us move. But otherwise, we're not supposed to do it. Okay. Before we start today's topic, I want to share with you something. I just came across, I was looking for it actually. I saw a letter many years ago, and I remember it had some amazing points in it. I saw a letter written by the third Chabad Rebbe, the Tzemach Tzedek, lived about 200 years ago. And I was thinking, I wanted to see something there. I was looking for a particular detail and I couldn't find it. Anyway, I Googled it and lo and behold, I found it. Right? I found it in English. Actually, I still can't find the Hebrew source, but because in Chabad.org, they actually translate the letter, but they forgot to put the reference. I don't know why, but so I couldn't look it up. It's an original, but it's a pretty accurate translation, I think. And it's just a fascinating letter because it contains things that we've been talking about over the last few weeks, put very succinctly. And I want to just quote a few excerpts of the letter. The letter was written to a mechutin of his, meaning there was a person called Rav Shlomo Freidus, whose daughter married the son of the Tzemach Tzedek. And this Rabbi Freidus had fallen ill, and he was very, very consumed with worry of his health and anxiety and all kinds of things. And then he prayed to God. He wrote to the Tzemach Tzedek that he's davening to Hashem to take away the fear and the worry. And the Tzemach Tzedek didn't like that response, and he wrote him the following letters. He said, so I'll just quote you a few little things. That's beautiful. Yes, it's true, he says, that we have to ask God for joy. As the psalm goes, Tehillim, it says, rejoice the soul of your servant. Similarly, in our prayers, one of our prayers in the evening prayers, we say, remove grief and moaning from amongst us. We ask God to help us get rid of anxiety, get rid of worry. He says, nevertheless, there's also the panic that a person brings upon himself. Right? We talked about this 2 weeks ago about worry. And every person has the choice and the control to prevent himself from doing so. He's very strong about that we have a choice, actually. It's a choice, right? There is clear proof of this. What's the proof, he says? The Torah prohibits, there's a whole section in the Torah in Deuteronomy where it talks about how Jews should go to war. You know that? By the way, we've seen, if you watch videos, we've seen an inaction of this actually. In modern day times, very often before they went into Gaza, there was a superior soldier or a general that would get up and say what the Torah says. And it says like this, the Torah prohibits a person from panic and fear at a time of war. Because the Kohen Gadol, an appointed, important Kohen, would get up before they went to war. In ancient times, he would say, biblical times, he would say, hear, O Israel, you're about to go into battle with your enemy. Don't let your hearts be frail. Do not fear, nor panic, nor be in dread of them. Right? They repeated these verses nowadays with those videos before they went to Gaza. A lot of times they would do this again. Right? So the Tzemach Tzedek writes, he says, this appears quite astonishing. What should a person then do if nevertheless his heart leaps and he panics when he sees the blood of battle? So how can you just remove worry, right? He says, but this is how it works. Every person's soul is closed with three external layers. We spoke about this, right? Thought, speech, and action. That's where the person's conduct takes place, and it is in these three layers that a person can exercise his free will. Every person can consciously choose what to think about, speak about, or do. In other words, the bottom line is that you actually can't change the emotion of worry and anxiety, but all our emotions need some form of expression. And that expression comes through what we call the three garments of the soul, which is thought, speech, and action. We've discussed this before. And that's what we can control. That's what the famous book, the Tanya, explains. We're not in control of our raw emotions. That's why we're not in control of the first initial feeling of those emotions, but we are in control of those things that give our emotions expression. We're in control of our thought, our speech, and action. And therefore, we can choose to think about something else. We can choose to do something that will take away the anxiety. We can choose to speak about positive things, right? And that's why, that's what he puts, that's what he sort of summarizes in this letter. It's a very beautiful summary of the whole concept. And he says, you have to stop articulating these troubling thoughts in your mind. And then he writes to him, he says, you should only speak about positive things and happy things. And at the end of the letter, he says he should make sure to sing only happy tunes. He says, so I heard from my grandfather, teacher, and master. He's talking about his grandfather, the first Chabad Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe. He says, when we were in a town called Piena on the night of his passing, I began to pray the evening prayer with a sad melody, and he stopped me from doing so. And he said, no, you mustn't daven with that sad tune. You must daven with a happy tune, because then it'll bring simcha and bring joy. Anyway, just an interesting perspective of how he wrote. He was quite sharp and hard about, you can choose. You have to work at removing that worry and that fear and the anxiety and so on. Okay. Today's topic. Before we do that, I want to remind everyone that next Thursday we'll still have a session. But more importantly, on the Friday, tomorrow week, is Purim, 9:15 at Ariella Spiridi's home, as we do every year. An hour of Purim, quick Megillah reading, an idea, some Hamantashen, Shloach Manot, and so on. All right, so today's topic, I want to talk about loneliness and isolation. Because one of the challenges people experience often is the feeling of loneliness and isolation. Right? It's a challenge, and it can be quite severe. And we often think we're very alone, and sometimes we often feel we're the only one experiencing this, and so on. And we know that this is the goes against the very core of the human experience. We've talked about this many times. Human beings were created to connect. Famous verse I've quoted many times, that it's not good for a person to be alone or lonely, as the Torah says when Adam was created. We are created to form relationships. In fact, what's interesting is, if you look in the Torah from the very beginning of Genesis till the Torah was given, which is all the way in the middle of Exodus, Shemot, right? We don't find so much about the relationship with God, we find more about relationships with people, the various marriages, the various relationships. And some of the commentaries explain, because the ultimate relationship is the relationship we have with God, also connection. But before we can have that relationship, we have to learn how to have a relationship with people. And that's why the Torah actually, the first book of the Torah actually is dedicated to human relationships. And then only then does the God give us the Torah and say, okay, now that you practice relationships, now I'll introduce you to a higher level relationship, which is the relationship with a higher being, relationship with God, right? Now we know that today in modern writings, there's a lot written about isolation and loneliness and the things that it can have and the effect that it can have on mental health, like depression, like anxiety, even things like suicidality, self-harm. There's even studies of cognitive decline. When people live in isolation or they live with loneliness, their mental and cognitive ability declines as well. So the question is, if someone is in isolation, if someone feels lonely, for whatever reason, when I say feels lonely, it doesn't only mean that they're alone without any people. They might feel alone in a challenge they're experiencing, which often is the case, right? Might feel alone because no one understands them. They might feel, whatever the case is, they might feel alone for a whole host of different reasons. The question is, what do we do about it? Before we answer that question, can I get someone to press that? Yeah? Yeah, just it's the right hand top corner. Just to put a bit of air. Thanks. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to share six things. The first is a very simple thing. And I'm going to take again from that book that I've been reading, some of the letters and the advice that the Lubavitcher Rebbe gave. He wrote extensively on this topic. And he gave it to different people. So the first thing is a very simple strategy. And that is, which nowadays has become a big thing actually, but it's an old idea, to understand that we're not alone in that particular struggle, and therefore to connect with other people that are going through the same challenge, right? So there's an old saying, an old adage, which is brought by some of the very early commentaries on the Talmud, in the name, it was brought also by the author of the Code of Jewish Law, Rabbi Yosef Karo. And he says, and it's also sourced in a Midrash, and it says, a trouble which is only of the individual is indeed a trouble. A trouble which is not only of the individual is not a trouble. Right? In other words, or differently put in different sources is, that Sarat Rabim, sometimes the challenge of a challenge of many is half a consolation. Now it's interesting because among the Jewish scholars throughout the ages, not everyone agreed with this. Some people took issue with this idea. He says there was a great Talmudist. His name was Rabbi Zev Shafran. He lived in the 19th century, and he said, "I don't relate to that." He said, "If I become aware that someone else is suffering with the same challenge, I'm no better off because I'm still suffering with the same challenge." Having said that, however, most authorities and most leading Talmudists and sages and Hasidic rabbis and so on and so forth accepted this idea. I think that is very simple because when there's a perception that you're suffering this alone, then that niggling noise of why me becomes much, much stronger. And like the feeling also of not being normal, is this a normal thing? Like I must be different to everyone else makes the pain so much greater. Of course, knowing that someone else suffers the same problem doesn't take away the problem, but it certainly makes it an easier load to bear because you understand that, first of all, it's a normal thing. I'm not the only one that's going through this. For whatever reason, we might not understand, but there are many other people that are suffering the same challenge. So you feel supported and you feel sort of understood a little bit and so on and so forth, right? The Rebbe writes in a letter to someone that had a particular challenge, he says, personal struggles are made exponentially worse when we think we're suffering alone, because it leads to more anxiety. We become anxious, panicky, scared that something is awfully wrong with us. In other words, only crazy people get this challenge. Only very evil people get this challenge. And you don't realize that's not true. There are other people going through this as well, right? And this was a recurring theme in any type of challenge, whether it's mental health, whether it's physical, whether it's whatever it is, whether it's family. It's always important to understand that others are going through the same thing. Which today we know is a very, very common thing. There's all over the world, there's these massive and very common to have these support groups where the underlying principle of support groups are that people connect and get together with other people going through the same challenge, right? Because they can strengthen each other. And I think also they can address one of the most basic human needs. And one of the most basic human needs apparently is to be understood, right? And when someone is going through a challenge, you can feel empathy, you can feel care from lots of people, but it's hard to feel really understood unless you're talking to someone who went through the same thing or is going through the same thing, right? Either going through the same thing or went through the same thing, because then you feel there's some sort of component of you feel that the person really gets me, the person really understands me. And we know that one of the basic needs of a person is to feel understood, not being felt understood as a very strong layer of loneliness, like no one gets me, right? But if you talk to other people that are going through the same idea, you feel understood, you understand each other, you strengthen each other, and you're able to support each other. That's why it's important to reach out when someone is going through a very strong challenge. Again, I think there's this fine line. Obviously, it's a nuance different. It doesn't mean to find every single human being on the planet that has gone through that thing and to become a needy person and sort of start defining yourself by that challenge suddenly because you feel you're part of a massive community that's going through the same challenge. That's not what you mean. Meaning to find people or a group or a small group that is struggling with the same thing so you feel understood and you feel you can support each other and you're kind of maybe more motivated then. That's the idea. Again, it's always what the goal is, right? It's always what the outcome is. You feel more motivated then what we can do together and advise each other and support each other to sort of get through it. That's the first idea. The second is not just people who are going through the challenge, but the second is to actually just share. Carrying a burden is really hard. When you carry a burden alone, it's very, very difficult. And we find sometimes when people don't share, the stress and the anxiety and the pain become stronger. Sometimes sharing with someone else, just the sharing itself, allows you to release the load. As the King Solomon said, and I've mentioned this many, many times, but it refers to all challenges. He talks about anxiety and worry. He says, "Da'aga b'lev is yashchena," that if you have worry in the heart of a person, speak it out. Speak it out to someone. Carrying it inside in your heart is very difficult. Just a few days ago, I happened to chance on an interview. There's an organization in New York called GEMS, and the GEMS that they record. They've had extensive interviews to preserve the memories and the conversations that the Lubavitcher Rebbe had with thousands and thousands of people. So they've interviewed people who have either them or their relatives have had stories or things that they can tell over. And just the other day, it's a local thing. I was watching, I just came across it, an interview they had with Mayor Moss, who was talking about his, I've heard the story before, but I just reminded myself of it. He was talking about his father. Many of you might have known who Sam Moss was, right? Sam Moss was he was a Holocaust survivor. He grew up in Munkács, Munkács, Hungary. In Munkács, there was a very, very great tzaddik. His name was the Mincha Salozer. He was a big Hasidic rebbe. He had memories. I spoke to him once about it. He actually told me some memories, and it was very fascinating. And then he went through terrible things. He learned in Cheder there, in Munkács, and then he went through the war, and him and his father, in a terrible way. And like many, many Holocaust survivors, never spoke about it for many years. Through a whole story, I'll say it because it's on the video, it's public, but he went to see the Lubavitcher Rebbe. His actual original intention was he was going to convince the Lubavitcher Rebbe to tell his son Meir to leave yeshiva because he wasn't that happy that he joined. Lately, he had tremendous nachas from him, but at the beginning, he was very not upset. He was very unhappy, and he thought, go to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I'll get him to tell him to leave. The audience went completely differently. So he came into the room, and the Rebbe asked him who he was, and the Rebbe actually stood up for him, and he told the story, actually put his hand on him, and he saw that it was a real Holocaust survivor in pain, and he asked him where he was from, and he told him he was from Munkács, and to the Rebbe that was very special, because the Rebbe had a very special relationship with that Mincha Salozer, that tzaddik that was in Hungary before the war. So first of all, he quizzed him, and he asked him to tell him stories and memories from Munkács, and the customs of that Rebbe, and so on and so forth. And then once he got him talking, he asked him to tell him his story of the survival and what he ended up, for the first time in many years, actually unloading the whole story to Lubavitcher Rebbe. Lubavitcher Rebbe didn't say anything, just listened. That was it, just listened. And then when he came out, he said that he feels like a complete load has been lifted off his heart. Didn't get any advice, nothing changed really. Right? Sometimes you just get a listening ear, provided that it's a real listening ear, of course. Right? You feel someone actually listening. It's just a way of getting rid of that loneliness. So what that requires is this, right? It goes both ways. What it requires people making the effort, right? Like every challenge, there's a choice element to it. And the choice element is you've got to be proactive. You've got to do something. So it means if a person is feeling lonely, loneliness is not a good thing to sit with. Isolation is not a good thing to sit with on any level, physically, emotionally, spiritually, whatever it is. So you've got to find someone to unload. It doesn't have to be someone going through the same challenge. That's one strategy. But the second strategy is just to unload, the unloading itself, just to share. Again, doesn't mean on social media, but it means to share with someone that you feel close to share with someone that you believe is listening. Just that itself creates a release, right? But this thing, and I want to mention it here, and I'll mention it a couple of times again, but this concept of dealing with isolation, this choice that I'm talking about, the strategy that I'm talking about, is not only on the person that's feeling lonely. It's actually a collective responsibility, right? Because it is hard to share. And therefore, the responsibility on every person dealing with the challenge of isolation, the responsibility of all of us, is to make it easier for people to reach out. Right, to make it easier for people to share by being available to share. It's an important thing, right? Because people will sense like if they can't share or not. And that's a kind of important thing. There's a famous idea about making it available to share, right? The power of this. You know, I often refer back to the story of Yosef HaTzadik, Joseph, which was a story that had just countless lessons on all levels. But we know that when Yosef, and we'll talk about him again later in a few minutes, but when Yosef was in prison in Egypt, isolated from his family, completely far away, being dumped by his brothers, he was in a faraway land, he was disconnected and so on. And he landed up in jail with the butler and the baker, right? The famous story, the butler and the baker. And the Torah says, but Yosef was a very proactive person, he was a very positive person, and he believed everything's from God, and you got to deal with it and so on. So not only, I guess, did he share with others, but he also made a point of in jail of helping others, right? And the Torah tells us this amazing story, how he woke up one morning and he came into the prison cell with the butler and the baker with him, and he saw them depressed, he saw them dejected. And he said four words. He said, Madua pneichem ra'im hayom. Why is your face something off today? Like, why are you off color today? What's wrong? And the power of that statement was that because of that statement, he eventually left jail, Yosef himself, and became the viceroy of Egypt and was able to save his brothers and to save, ultimately create the genesis of the Jewish nation. Why? Because as soon as he said that, he noticed that they weren't feeling well. He noticed something was off. He noticed something was wrong. He didn't pry. He just said, "What's up? Is everything okay? Good morning. Like, you look a little off today. What's wrong?" That's it. They could have said nothing. And some people do, unfortunately. And then you're stuck. You can't, you know. But they didn't. They saw a genuine interest. They saw something reaching out. They saw someone just saying, "I care. You look off. What's wrong?" And they unburdened. They told them about the dreams they had the night before. And then one of them was the butler, and he told them that, and he said that the interpretation of your dream, Yosef was able to interpret dreams, and he told the butler in 3 days, the king Pharaoh will restore you to your original position, and I'm just going to ask you a favor, while you're there, put in a good word for me, because I'm stuck here far from my family, and if I can get out, it'll be really good. And the butler came out and he forgot. Until 2 years later, when Pharaoh had a dream, and couldn't find anyone to interpret his dream, suddenly the butler remembered and came to Pharaoh and said, "Look, I don't want to bring this up, but you know, I was once in jail because of you. You threw me in jail. I sinned. And over there was this guy, and he knew how to interpret dreams because he interpreted my dreams. And it was true. And you restored me to my position." So Pharaoh says, "Bring him." The Talmud said it was actually on Rosh Hashanah. And they ran and they took Yosef out of jail. And within hours, he became the most prominent person in Egypt because he helped Pharaoh and Pharaoh promoted him and the whole story. Right? Where did it come from? Four words. Madua pneichem ra'im hayom. What's wrong? You look off color. Right, so what I'm saying is this idea of sharing with others, just sharing, unloading the burden, just releasing, is something that is hard to do but so important. And that's why collectively we have the responsibility, not only the person who's suffering isolation to actually make the effort, but people making the effort to make it easier, to be available, to sound like you want to listen. Third strategy is the very important one. We've talked about this before, but let's mention it again in this context. And that is that sometimes not just about sharing. Sometimes it's reaching out for help. For people who we know maybe will be able to help us. And that goes back to the principle we've talked about so many times, that the world is just a world of giving and receiving. And we have to know how to give. And sometimes we have to know how to receive. And sometimes receiving for a lot of people is harder than giving, right? The Rebbe once wrote to someone who the Rebbe felt that he could get advice and get support from people who were near to him. I think it was like a young person or a teenager, whatever. And the Rebbe writes like this, very interesting. He says, "One needs only to feel for those who refuse to accept a helping hand from near and dear ones, including parents. I do not mean to say that one must readily submit to parental dictatorship." He knew he was talking to, right? So he says, I'm not telling you have to become, you know. "But neither does it mean that one should always reject parental advice and help in the hope that eventually things will straighten out themselves. Because things often don't straighten out themselves, right? And sometimes we do need to ask people who are older, people who are wiser, people who are more experiencing." And it was interesting. I know that the Rebbe, you know, would answer many, and there was thousands and thousands of letters daily to the Rebbe that people seeking advice. Sometimes the Rebbe would give advice, but not always. Sometimes the Rebbe would tell people to go and seek advice from others, and he had a few very famous catchphrases. Because he felt that people should consult people. There were two themes. One was that you need to consult someone that really, really cares for you, but someone also has some experience or expertise or life experience that could really advise you. And those two things have to go together. So for example, there was this concept that the Lubavitcher Rebbe had, very fascinating, about seeking medical advice. If someone have a medical problem, often the Rebbe would answer, "Ka'atzat, follow the advice of Rofe Yedid, a doctor who's a friend." Doctor's a friend. Meaning, not just a friend. The friend will give you medical advice that they found on Google. That's not gonna help. It has to be a doctor, someone that understands medicine, but he cares for you. He's a Yedid, is your friend. So that unbelievable combination, Rofe Yedid, right? Sometimes, I had this answer once. In fact, I had this answer with regards to coming to Australia. So if I tell you who it is, you can either curse them out or thank them. Either one, it's your choice. But finally, when I got the advice and kind of went back to the Rebbe afterwards and asked his, he gave me the final blessing and the final thing. But when I got the idea to come to Australia, the Rebbe asked me, told me, Ka'atzat, like the plan, this was, it was a very famous line, this we use often, consult Yedidim Mevinim, friends who understand. Meaning not just like a teenage friend from a yeshiva or something that doesn't understand anything, but someone who's got some experience, someone understands the question you're asking, someone has a bit of life experience, understand what it means, I guess, to move across the world, to take your wife away from her family, whatever they have to understand, right? But also is really a friend of yours. He understands the concept, but also really cares for you. And will know what's best for you, or will try at least, knows what's best for you, right? So this idea of reaching out for help, which is difficult in its own right, but also being humble enough to reach out for those who might know more than you, or might have more experience than you, or might have more expertise than you, but you know they care for you, reaching out to them to help you and support you, right? Again, it's not such an easy thing, but this is the concept. Number four is a very, very interesting concept, very interesting idea. And I refer to it as spiritual mathematics. What does that mean? The power of getting a connection, the power of making a point to share with others and just work through something with someone else. Could be anyone. It could be a friend. Obviously, there's a place to go ask someone who has expertise. There's a place to ask someone who's going through the same challenge. There's a place just to share. Then there's this depth of just connection. And the way it works is like this. It comes from a saying of the second Chabad Rebbe, who said the following. He said, he was talking about the idea of Avat Israel, of Jews connecting, community, connecting with each other and so on. And he said that when two people get together, he said it's two godly souls against one animal soul. Now, what's the maths there? Doesn't seem to make sense, right? We each have a godly soul and an animal soul. In fact, everything now has good and bad. Since the sin, Kabbalistically, we learn that since the sin of the first fruit, we all have good and bad, right? The human beings, for sure, that we have an animal soul and a godly soul. So when I get together with you, it's two godly souls and two animal souls, right? So what have we accomplished? So he says, very, very simple. There's a very, very huge difference between the godly soul and the animal soul. The animal soul is egocentric. The animal soul is self-absorbed. The animal soul is not about the greater good. The animal soul is about what is good for me now. My animal soul is interested in my pleasure, in the pursuit of my pleasure, what I can derive pleasure and happiness from in this moment, right? My animal soul is not interested in you, and is not interested about tomorrow. He's interested about now, in a very egocentric, self-absorbed, hedonistic way. That's it. I'm talking about an untrained animal soul, right? And in fact, on the contrary, the ego of the animal soul is such that it actually is threatened by other people. That's where being threatened comes from. It comes from ego. That you find it hard. You're not secure enough to make place for others, right? That is, ego lives in the animal soul. That's the animalistic, the animal consciousness of the person is the egocentricity. So my animal soul actually loses a lot of interest in you unless it thinks it can gain for itself. Which sometimes, by the way, relationships, the connections happen like that. That's when they break down. When people enter into relationships, it might sound like a very good relationship, but actually it's not, because someone is in the relationship for themselves, not for the other person. They're using the other person. They're using the other person for their own gain. So ultimately, the animal soul, even when it's connecting to someone else, even when it's communicating with someone else, talking to someone else, spending time with someone else, its intention, its goal is itself. The godly soul is totally different. The godly soul is where selflessness lives, as we've spoken about many times. The godly soul is about the greater good. The godly soul is about giving. The godly soul doesn't have ego. It's not threatened by other people. It's on the contrary. It wants to give. It wants to support. It wants to help. Right? So now we can understand the spiritual math. When we get together, we don't have two animal souls yet, because they're not, on the contrary, they're actually fighting with each other. So what do we have? We have two godly souls looking out for each other. So therefore, that's why he said it's two godly souls versus one animal soul. That's the depth, the spiritual depth of getting support from other people. In other words, it's so much easier to get chizuk, to get strength from other people, because when you try to help me, you're not adding your animal soul onto me, because your animal soul is not interested in me, but you're adding your godly soul to me. So therefore now, against my animal soul, which is where all my challenges live, and all my anxieties live, and all my fears live, and everything's happening on the animal soul level, I've got two godly souls, mine and yours, trying to support and strengthen and pull through my animal soul. So that's the spiritual map, the depth of the power of connection and the power of getting together. The fifth thing I want to share with you is, I spoke before about, you know, reaching out to others, making it more, making it available and so on, but it's not just that. It's about the importance of building community, right? Through kindness, through giving. Now we know in Judaism, community is like a central theme, right? The Rabbi Akiva, right? Rabbi Akiva, the famous Rabbi Akiva, said that the verse in the Torah, "V'ahavta l'racha kamocha," love your fellow like yourself, klal gadol b'Torah, is a fundamental rule in the Torah, right? How does community happen? So it's a mindset. First of all, it's a culture. It's a culture about that we are a community and we have to look out for each other. We have to look out as a collectively, you know, community has to create organization, has to create systems. We find in the Talmud like huge, huge detail about every community had to have a welfare system and a tzedakah system and all the houses of hospitality, all these different types of things. The concept of community is very strong and very unique in the Jewish community. The bigger the communities, we find often that the more people there are, it's obviously easier to build a community. One community that is incredibly successful in doing this is in America. In Israel too, but in America there's this incredible wealth of organizations that are so community-minded. I'll tell you a cute little story. My daughter, Hanala, who lives in Brooklyn, a couple of weeks ago, she actually, was the whole thing, she was sick, and then she thought she got better. In truth, she wasn't better. She got pneumonia, essentially, and she couldn't breathe in all night. So, okay, call that Sola. Sola now is universal. But she has three little kids, and it was middle of the night. She couldn't really call anyone. So her husband had to stay home with the three little kids, and she went off with the ambulance to the emergency room herself. She went to a hospital called Maimonides Hospital in Borough Park. She's sitting there. She's there for 2 minutes, and a very Haredi, Hasidic-looking guy, I think lives in Williamsburg, comes over to her. "Why are you here? Do you need help?" Turns out like this. One of the communities, the Satma community actually in Williamsburg, which is a super, super Haredi community, but people, and sometimes they get bad press because, you know, they do strange things sometimes. True, but and they're very like over-the-top stringent sometimes. But what people don't know is that they have this most incredible sense of chesed, of community. They take the cake when it comes to community, building community. And they have all these organizations. One of them is called the Bikur Cholim, like visiting the sick. They have busloads every day of volunteers that go visit people in the hospital. Doesn't matter who it is. They don't care who it is, how religious you are. They visit, you know. One of the sections of this organization is they have people who hang out in the emergency room each night. For people like my daughter who come alone, my daughter's not the type. I mean, she's a strong person, but she's not going to advocate for herself. She's not going to drive them crazy. She's not that type, right? I'm not that type. I don't know if I landed up alone, I'll just do whatever they tell me to do, right? But, you know, in medicine, you need advocacy. You need strong voices. You need people to rush people up sometimes. And this is what they do. They're there. They sit out there all night waiting for people like my daughter who came alone, couldn't come with the family, and said, "We'll take over." And they did. They made sure the doctor came, and they made a bit of a tumult when they needed to, and she got her thing, and she was fine. I mean, she was okay. But I just thought it's like amazing. It's like the most incredible thing. Yeah. Now in America, in New York area, there is an organization for everything. It's unbelievable. You're never alone. It's like the most incredible thing. I have a sister-in-law involved in one of these organizations. The things they do is absolutely phenomenal. And I've heard from people who are not in part of the community, non-Jews, whatever the case is, when they experience it, they are blown away. They cannot understand the sense of responsibility. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Bazeh. I'm sure you've heard the phrase, right? We're all responsible for each other. That idea of, but it takes a lot of people to create a culture like that. It's a spirit of giving, right? I mean, we're not big enough yet to have that. And it's not important enough, I guess. But you know, if you're driving in New York, in the New York Jewish communities, and you get a flat tire, or something gets. Have you ever had the experience?
I was going to say,
Chaverim, I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's the same in
London. Yeah, it's spreading out a lot of communities. Yeah. There's something called Chaverim. Chaverim means friends, right? If you have a diamond ring and it got got lost down a drain and you don't know what to do about it, you call them, they'll find it for you. They'll come a whole team, volunteers. They'll come, they have these machines, they'll go down and they'll work until they find it. I've seen a video, I've seen it happen. Because I posted, I'm on a WhatsApp group which shows these beautiful videos all over the world, these huge videos. And it's just incredible, right? I mean, it's like phenomenal. I mean, besides that, solar, and then they have these real things about medical care and high lifeline for cancer patients, the cancer, I mean, everything. You can't imagine, right? It's such, obviously critical mass helps. They even have something, which you never ever need it, but there's something called mitaskim. Someone loses a loved one, they have to sit shiver, you make one phone call. They bring you whatever you need. Load chairs, a Torah scroll if you have one, have a minion. Sidurim, I've seen in the winter they bring coat racks, they'll bring whatever you need, they bring you. Now, it's like people do this just for no reason. Like,
yeah, it's and
yeah, all these things. It's incredible. It's incredible. So I'm just bringing an example because I was blown away. My daughter. This one I didn't know about actually. The one that's sitting in the emergency room. I knew about the others, but like I was just blown away. Like I couldn't believe it. Like it's really unbelievable. But that's what it is. Connection. Isolation drops when you have that sense of community. When you know there's always someone out there. You might never even talk to them because maybe you never need it. And for most things, you know what? You should never need it. We should never need it. But then, right, we should never need Miss Askin. We should never need Khaberi, whatever, but we do. Right? We knowing that you're not alone, knowing there's always a community looking out for you. Look, it's not perfect because always people fall down through the cracks, but this idea of creating a culture of community is such an important thing. And the final point I wanted to make is this. And again, I want to go back to Yosef. So always remember when we were alone, that we were never alone. And it is expressed in the story, the following story. You're always part of a whole, no matter what happens. Right? You're never alone. And what happens to you is important, and important to the bigger picture. So one of the things, the stories of Yosef, a fascinating story. I think I related it many, many years ago in one of the Thursday mornings. But when he comes down to Egypt, he works. He he's a young boy, 17, right? He's sold down to slavery. He comes to Egypt. He gets sold to the family of Potiphar. Potiphar was one of the big machers in Pharaoh's palace. And Potiphar's wife is not a very savory person, I guess you could say. She takes a liking to him. And she tries to seduce him, right? She tries over a long period of time, according to the Chumash, according to the Talmud. She tried all sorts of ways, right? Her final attempt was Yosef again. I have to understand the context here. Yosef is far away from his family. It's becoming quite hard to resist the temptation. She finally, what she does is, according to the Chumash, she waits for a day. There was some sort of public holiday where everyone went off to church or something. And she said she's not feeling well. And he didn't go because he wasn't a pagan worshiper. And he came to do work at the house, and there she was, and it was just her and him, right? And she really pushes him. And he's got nothing to lose. In fact, he's got everything to lose by saying no. She was a very powerful woman. He's got everything to gain, really, by saying yes, because she could, you know, she has the power to give him stuff and all that kind of thing. And no one's going to ever know, and he could just do it. And in fact, it became so difficult that the Talmud explains the nuances in the Chumash that he was wavering. There's a phrase there that hints to the fact that he was wavering. And he was coming close to actually finally caving in. When the Talmud says that the image of his father appeared in the window. That's what it says. Image of his father in the window. Right? And he turned around and the Pasuk says, Vayema'en, he refused. With great strength. Right? And the question the commentaries ask, what did he see? So okay, he saw the image of his father. Okay, nice. But what's the symbolism behind that? So in Kabbalah we learn the following. Based on a piece of the Talmud, that there was a very important message with the image of his father. It wasn't just that he was his father, right? There was an important message. It was like this. The Zohar says, and the Talmud says, that Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, who was ultimately the father of the 12 tribes, the father of the Jewish nation, saw he was in the same soul as Adam, as the first human being, right? And he looked like Adam, in fact. So when Joseph saw Jacob in the window, he actually saw Adam. What was Adam? Adam was created alone, says the Talmud. He was created as one person. And Adam, very soon after he was created, sinned. He did the wrong thing. And it was the wrong thing, because God had told him not to eat from the tree of life, and tree of the knowledge, and he did. And you might think, okay, so that was something that he did. He was affected, and he had to make amends. But that's not the way it was. When Adam did it, he affected the entire world. And we still, spiritually, are suffering from the sin of the first fruit till today. In fact, one of the reasons we make Kiddush every Friday night, because some commentaries tell us that the first fruit was a grape. And therefore, the idea of making Kiddush on the grape of Friday night is like fixing, bringing a tikkun. And until Mashiach comes, we're busy fixing the problem of the very, very first mistake. When Yaakov appears in the window with the visual image of Adam, Yosef gets the message very strongly. And it's a negative and positive message. I mean, it's a responsibility and a privilege that you're never alone. You are part of a whole. What you do affects everyone else. Your strength makes everyone stronger. Your weakness can weaken everyone else as well. Right? What we do affects the whole world. Why? Because we actually are never alone. We're not alone. We're not alone. We're not a yachid. We're not an individual person. We're not a singular person. We're part of a great whole. But also, it's a tremendous source of encouragement. Because we know that what we do and the strength we have and the inspiration we have is not just for us. If it was just for yourself, you would have said, okay, you know what, this is just too hard. I don't need to do this. I'm alone anyway, let me just fail and it's fine, I'll manage. And no one's going to ever know. But then you realize, no, I'm not alone. Whatever I do will strengthen everyone else. It will make, will bring holiness to everyone else. It will bring inspiration to everyone else. It's still inspiring us till today, those verses in the Chumash, the strength of Yosef and so on and so forth. Therefore we know that even before we get to other people and before we connect to other people, we're never alone. So just in summary, 6 points about isolation. First, we need to connect with others in the same challenge. We need to share with others. Just reaching out, just regular thing, right? We have to know how to take. We have to know how to reach out for help. So important. Those that know and those that are we can trust, but also understand the situation, maybe more than us. The spiritual mathematics, the depth of connection, which is two godly souls against one animal soul. The importance of participating in community and creating community. And the lesson that we're never alone. Again, a reminder, next Thursday we continue on. But next Friday, the Purim, 9:15 at Ariella in Vaucluse. As every Purim, have a wonderful week.